Commentary Track. Conversations with film historians and filmmakers. With Frank Thompson.
Hello, welcome to the Commentary Track. I'm your host, Frank Thompson, but my pals Spinner and Paddlefoot call me Clutch. You know, back when the Commentary Track was just a gleam in my eye, I made up a wish list of people who I wanted to be guests, and that wish list was made up of really the top film historians in the field, and I have been incredibly fortunate to have some of those top film historians on the podcast. Kevin Brownlow, Rudy Belmer, such wannabes as that. But also on that original list was today's guest, Jerry Beck. Jerry is as knowledgeable about animation, or as I like to call them, cartoons, as anybody I've ever met. And he has really made his mark in the field. He's written books. He has done DVD commentary. He now teaches a class in animation history. And every month, Jerry and Frank Conniff, who you'll remember as TV's Frank from Mystery Science Theater 3000, do an incredibly funny show at the Steve Allen Theater in Hollywood called Cartoon Dump, in which they show some of the most horrendously awful cartoons that you will ever see. And a good time is had by all. But luckily for me, Jerry also likes good cartoons, and so we spent some time talking about our favorites, and for me, that is Warner Brothers cartoons, and Looney Tunes, and of course the incredible early 30s stuff by Max Fleischer. My other favorite, Winsor McCay, didn't even come up in this interview, which is just one reason why we're going to have to get together with Jerry again sooner than later for part two of this interview, but part one is cool enough, so settle in and enjoy this talk about cartoons with Jerry Beck. I started watching cartoons, well, when I was a little kid, obviously Captain Kangaroo and stuff like that. I remember Tom Terrific and Mighty Manfred the Wonder Dog, but it was in the early 60s that I really started getting a real love for it, and it seems to me that that was the best of times and the worst of times, because we were getting the Warner Brothers cartoons, the Fleischer cartoons, and then we were also getting Mighty Hercules, right, and that horrible, horrible stuff, Clutch Cargo, all these things. So you must have started getting introduced to cartoons around that same time.
Oh, right? Absolutely, definitely. I was definitely I was born in 55. So, I was, by the time I was 5 years old, the Flintstones had just come on, and all these early TV cartoons had come on, and of course the classic cartoons came on. And it was a great time to be in watching television, and especially as a young kid, you're immersed in the history of film. You know, Laurel and Hardy, The Little Rascals, you know, Three Stooges, and of course all the other films that were on at that time. And plus, you had what was going on in the present day, you know, of TV. So you kind of had the history of the medium, both, you know, films in general, but animation in particular, you know, in that 1960s period. And so, we were just raised with it. Now, my situation was that I didn't, people think, oh, you must have loved cartoons since you were a little kid. And, of course, who doesn't? But it wasn't until in the 70s, until my teenage years, that I really looked at them again and, like, realized how brilliant they were. I'm talking about the Warner Brothers cartoons in particular, and Disney cartoons, Disney animation, and I was a, you know, typical kid of the 60s into the fandom, which was kind of underground then. It wasn't like today with Comic-Con, you know, and all this stuff. It was, I read comic books and the Marvel comics and the DC comics. I got into all that, and I watched the cartoons. I was up on all of that stuff, you know, whether when George of the Jungle came on in the late 60s and, you know, any of those cartoons. I was interested in the adventure cartoons, but they never went far enough, you know. I still remember being disappointed by that Lone Ranger cartoon that came on.
Oh, yeah.
Remember that one? It was kind of odd, and Hot Wheels. We know that there's some really good artists behind them now, and actually in some ways, if you look at them from my adult eyes, they look kind of cool, those shows. But as a kid, they were just kind of stilted, you know, they were stiff and boring. And actually, in the late 60s, I'm going off on my, one of my many tangents, but in the late 60s, we started to get Speed Racer and Eighth Man, you know, which were from Japan. I didn't know that then. Nobody did. But they were, there was something to them. There was something more action-packed about them. They were using the medium better, and a lot of us picked up on those shows as well. But it wasn't until my 70s, I'm not there yet, but the 1970s when looked at the cartoons coming home from high school and really began to appreciate, you know, the humor and the design and everything. And I wondered, how do they make these things? And then I started going to comic book conventions, and that was where I first saw a cartoon with an audience, and the audience laughs at it. It was like a Daffy Duck cartoon. And I think it was Birth of a Notion, one with a Peter Lorre mad scientist, and I just hearing a crowd of people laughing at these cartoons I'd been watching in silence at home was really a revelation. Oh, they were meant for theaters. Oh, they were meant for audiences, and you could, everything just came fell into place about what they were and how they were, and that's what led me to want to know more about them. I was an amateur high school cartoonist, and I wanted to be in. Work in animation or work in that world. And that world didn't exist, though. That's the problem back in the 1970s. So actually getting into its history was the only option I had, in a way. I wasn't good enough back then to, you had to be unbelievably good to be in the business. The business was still populated by all the old timers from the sure. 1930s and 40s and 50s. They're still there. So you had to be amazing young talent to get to break through, and but there was nobody really looking into the whole animation history thing. So that's kind of what had my epiphany in late high school, early after high school period.
Yeah, I think in the 1970s was when you first started. I mean, people like Mike Barrier and
yep.
That seemed to be taking it seriously.
It's weird because even I still. Remember that telling people you collected comic books was like a big taboo back then. You know, if you were into that fandom, so that was kind of a closet, quiet, you know, interest you had. So I guess science fiction fans may have had the same. I don't know because I wasn't a big science fiction fan. You know, like guys who read paperback novels and that. I wasn't into that then, but I have a feeling they had that same. Situation in the 30s and 40s and 50s. But for comic book people, it was really an underground thing. And there were comic book conventions and there were fanzines, but they were all sort of undergroundy. I forgot what you said.
How it started being, sorry. Animation started being taken seriously in the 70s with people like Mike Barrier John Kanemaker.
Okay. I know where
these
I was
guys.
Going. Okay. So it was at the comic book conventions that I personally saw an issue of Funny World, and I could not believe it was Funny World 13, and I remember, you know, and Bob Clampett interview, and it said something like interview with Carl Stalling. I'm thinking, does anybody even in this room of comic book nerds, and really back then, did anybody know these names other than me? I really felt that way, and I picked up that magazine, and it was like, wow, you know, there are people who care about this, and Mike Barrier is so great. He still is right now with his website. But he not only published the fanzine. Back then, fanzines looked, you know, funky. They were typewriter written on Mimeode. And, you know, I don't even know if they were Xeroxed. But his was a professional printed typeset laid out beautifully magazine about this arcane subject of animated cartoons and its history. So that was a big influence on me I've had that my whole life, that animation isn't just for kids and the history of animation isn't just a kiddie thing. It shouldn't be, you know. I was happy, I'm jumping around in my history, but I'm happy that I got to work with Leonard Maltin, and it was a kind of a fluke that the publisher that took on Of Mice and Magic, I say it's a fluke because it could have been any publisher. But the publisher that ultimately took it on, it was New American Library, and they sold the hardcover rights to McGraw-Hill. That's the fluke, because Leonard had already been doing his movie guide for New American Library, and still does, you know, for the Plume books, Signet books.
And they agreed to do Of Mice and Magic, and but they figured they weren't at the time affiliated at all with a hardcover. They were just soft cover. I think today they're part of Random House or something, but back then they were their own little company. And they sold the hardcover rights to McGraw-Hill, which was an odd choice, even though they had done some high-profile biographies, and they did a Beatles biography, and they were doing the Irma Bombeck book. They were doing some commercial books. They were mainly a textbook publisher. That was mainly what they did. There's actually a store. I come from New York, and it may still be there. I haven't been there in years, but there was a McGraw-Hill bookstore on 6th Avenue, kind of across the street from Radio City Music Hall. And I'm assuming maybe McGraw-Hill was in that building too, but there was a company store there, and they just had the McGraw-Hill book. So I remember going there in 1979-80, just, you know, kind of wondering, you know, who this publisher was. And I saw nothing but textbooks. It was weird. It was like, you know, it was major scientific books and, you know, things for NASA. It was very strange. But I always thought that was later on I realized that I think that was a real blessing, because their mindset was to lay out the book like a textbook, which is what they did. And that's great. I mean, now I'm so happy about that, but at the time it seemed kind of dry. You know, a book about cartoons should be lively and full of wacky images and stuff. But no. This textbook approach was exactly what we needed, because it really made this what people considered a goofy subject, you know, and made it look serious. You know, it gave it a gravitas, you know, gave it some weight that it was a serious thing to study. And I think that's part of it, and not that the book and the text and everything else didn't also lend to it, but also the layout. And that's how I feel also about Mike Barrier's magazines. They were just having that professional adult point of view helps our cause, those of us who love, you know, cartoons are always the stepchild, whether it's in the film industry or even in film history. You know, it's the one the other historians don't really want to look, don't care to look into. I was immersed in the 1970s. I became friends and still am with many, many of the New York film buffs, you know, and not just film buffs, the people who collected them, but I mean guys who really seriously wrote about it, with, you know, William Caverson, John Cocci, and the people who were in town. Chris Steinbrunner was a friend of mine. I don't know if you know all these people, but
sure.
You
knew them all.
Yeah, you know, it was a serious group of people who cared about film history, and many others that I'm not even naming right now. You know, Dick Bann and on and on and on, if I think about it. You know, and those guys were great. They were into, like me, I was into regular films and shorts and serials and B-Westerns. They were all into that too. But cartoons were really the sub-basement. And once I sort of raised my hand and said, I'm the cartoon guy. I'm researching this stuff. I'm looking into it. What was cool was they all would hand me things. They'd say, and this is the pre-internet days and pre-books about animation, maybe except for one or two Disney books. And but people would say, they just hand me, oh, Jerry, you know, there's a cartoon thing here. Or they would give me a film, or they would, you know, tell me about something I didn't know that they happened in all of their voluminous film watching. They would say, hey, I just saw an odd film with a cartoon segment. You got to check this out, and maybe you know who did it, you know. But, you know, and that's how my own knowledge gained, by being around a group of like-minded people, and being the one who said I'd be the receptacle for all your animation knowledge or anything else you guys want to throw my way. And that definitely helped me, you know, in my path of doing this. And so, you know, but it's just unusual that the real film scholars, animation was just a notch or two or five below what they were doing. It was just related but not related. And so I kind of took it on as the cause, you know. It needed a champion. We needed to, you know, get more of this out there and let people know what I'm seeing, which is, hey, these are funny and these are artistic and these are interesting. And that's been my whole goal in life. That's everything I've been doing ever since.
Yeah, they're funny, but they're more than funny. They're, I mean.
Well, they're classics. I mean, I still to this day, I just, in the front of the 100 Greatest Looney Tunes book, I've said something I've been saying for years, which is that these are just as classic. I'm talking about Looney Tunes in this specific case, but it can really apply to all the old Hollywood theatricals. These are just as classic as Gone with the Wind and Wizard of Oz and Casablanca, the ones that the studios themselves revere. You know, Singing in the Rain. You know, there's brand new restorations on DVD of I Love Lucy and the Honeymooners. Believe me, I love both series. But cartoons don't get that treatment, and they're just as valid as those things. And so and that's what I've been doing lately in the last, 10, 15, 20 years is pushing the animation stuff that you can get, I'm still working on it. There's still libraries, the Fleischer cartoons of the 30s and George Pal puppetoons, things like that. They're not out there, and they're still locked away in the vaults because the studios that own them think they're junk. They're just old cartoons, old kids fodder,
Yeah, it's really frustrating. I started collecting films in the mid 70s, and
me too.
Started collecting cartoons because they were the greatest thing to have. Not only because they were slightly more affordable, because they were one reel instead of a feature, but also the very idea that I could have a print of King Size Canary or What's Opera Doc or I haven't got a hat. Any of these things that are just so incredibly good.
I remember when I got into it too, that was my late high school years, and people have asked me what I have a couple of cells here and there. I don't buy animation art. I'm not an animation art collector, but I have some things that I've accumulated or acquired throughout my travels in many years. But that said, people ask me, why don't you collect the artwork that much? And I go, because you know what? From where I came from that period, when I realized you could own King Size Canary, the whole cartoon, I didn't need the artwork. I felt like I've got everything right here. I'd rather have the finished product than one frame of it, although I certainly realize and would value, one frame of any of those films. I remember in my high school era, I went to a party. And I rarely did that. I was pretty much an introvert, pretty nerdy, reading my comic books and stuff. But I remember going to a party that a friend of mine was holding in his house, in his mother's house, I guess. And it was a big deal. And then people were passing around the joints and listening to rock and roll with headphones. And I mean, it was a real teenage party of the 70s, early 70s. And one guy brought over and lugged over a Bell and Howell movie projector, and he ran movies while everybody else was kind of partying or sitting or smoking or hanging out. And I still remember, and I was like, I wasn't partaking, but he put on the reel, and I didn't know what the hell this was, except I knew films from school where they'd show us educational films in school. And he put on the Mickey Mouse Club, and it blew my mind. It was an episode of the Mickey Mouse Club, and I hadn't seen that in at least 10 years, and the idea of having that, owning that, possessing those memories, being able to have that was not even a thought. But then once I saw that, in person, here it is. It was like a time machine, this projector. It brought me back personally to my youth. And I wanted those. I wanted to collect that. And the guy who's became a friend of mine told me basically, look in a popular science magazine, there'd be like in the classifieds, there's little ads for, 16 millimeter home movies for sale. And I think that led me to one of the, I forgot the name of it now. It was actually a place in New York. Are you from New York by any chance?
No.
Oh, okay. There was a store, there was actually a storefront on 57th Street that sold 16 millimeter film. I don't even, to this day, can't figure out how they stayed in business or what they were doing. But I walked in there and they had movies, just had all kinds of oddball films on a shelf. And I just said, do you have any cartoons? And I think I still have my print of Sliphorn King of Polaroo, a Walter Lantz Swing Symphony from that store from those days. I still have that print. But that was the beginning of my never look back. I have a garage full of film right now.
I think I was in high school or maybe junior high when the Woody Woodpecker show was on TV. And Walter Lantz would be on, but the real treasure of that show was there was almost always an Avery.
Oh, and well, there couldn't be too many. Well, there was only four Averys. No,
well, yeah. they kept playing them though, and I think Crazy Mixed Up Pup is probably my introduction to Avery. It's probably the very first Avery I ever saw, and I loved it. Still have a 16mm print of it.
Yep.
Still think it's one of the greatest cartoons ever. Not realizing that Avery's MGM stuff was far better, but even so, I love this one. But I took it seriously right away. I mean, as soon as I saw Crazy Mixed Up Pup, I thought, this is not only funny, this is ingenious, and the art is tremendous, and all the takes and everything that they're doing are so surreal and so great, that there's real artistry there. And as soon as I realized that, so luckily, I started collecting when I was in Chicago.
Uh-huh.
I was working at a place called Facets Multimedia.
Oh, yeah.
And before that, I was working at a Disney non-theatrical
depot. Oh, yeah, really? Really?
In Chicago.
I've got stories about that.
And, but I knew a bunch of people who collected cartoons and who were enthusiastic about cartoons. And so, you know, they'd say, hey, have you ever seen One Froggy Evening? And I would say, well, man, I don't know. What is it? Because I never knew the titles
of any
of this.
And that's what led me to work on, to do a book with, you know, with Wilfried Wald. We did a book that identifies all the cartoons. Because I've told this story often, but, you know, I went in the 70s when I was getting into it. And believe me, I was into it all along. I just didn't realize I was into it. You know, I mean, I definitely saw Avery as a kid. Because I always drew, I drew in my little book throughout my high school years, and I was always drawing pictures of, like, the wolf with his eyes, you know, those wild takes. I would always draw those. I never knew where they came from. I never even thought about it. It was just, it came from watching them as a kid, and I did it over and over and over again. It was just a thing I used to do. And then it was in those high school years that I got to see some Tex Avery cartoons again, and realized that, hey, that's what I've been copying all these years. This thing I saw when I was 5 and 6 and 7. There was a pre-48 MGM package that didn't have Tom and Jerry in it, but it had all the Tex Averys and harmonizing cartoons that they ran in New York in early morning. So I now know that that's what I grew up watching, a lot of those cartoons as well. And you said you worked for Facets.
Yeah, I worked for Facets Multimedia in Chicago as a projectionist and whatever else. And that was right after I had left Disney non-theatrical.
Yes, I'm going to ask you about that, too.
In Chicago.
We're going to turn the tables.
And went to Facets.
We're going to turn the tables and interview.
Uh-oh.
No. Just Facets, was that a theater?
Yeah.
Yeah. It was a repertory theater.
It was a repertory theater. It had two screens. Mm-hmm. One was just a little sweat box, and one was a pretty good size theater. It was an infuriating place to work for me and for my other real movie guy friends. And that's where a lot of us met, a lot of the guys who traded animation. They would show pan and scan prints of Scope films, and it just drove me crazy because it was a theater. It wasn't somebody's house. The guy who ran it just didn't care.
But they were running 16mm.
Yeah,
prints.
They were running 16.
Yeah.
They never had 35 the whole time I was there.
Yeah. No, I remember the name because I used to work in 16mm non-theatrical. That was my first job in the business. I worked at some places before that, but that's beside the point. But I worked for United Artists in MGM UA or UA 16. Mm-hmm. In 1980 was when I first started working for UA 16. I worked for United Artists for 2 years earlier than that, but it was in a different department that generated producers' accounting reports. It was a boring thing, but it was my foot in the door in the movie business. And then I inched my way over to the 16mm department. I remember renting. We used to rent movies to Facets Multimedia.
Yeah.
And I always wondered about that because it was theatrical, but yet they were running 16, which is very unusual even then. But I remember us doing that, and we would send all those prints out of Cincinnati. I don't know if you were involved with any or receiving any of the films.
We had to receive some of the stuff. We were all pretty much volunteer, nothing. But then I got hired to be a projectionist, and I was there for a long time. I went on from there to Atlanta, where I worked at Audio Brandon and Films Inc.
Oh, yeah.
And Films Inc., because it had all the MGM stuff.
You're a 16-millimeter rental guy like me.
Yeah.
And George Feltenstein.
And George Feltenstein, who I knew slightly in those days.
Well, you need to interview George if you haven't done that yet.
I have not.
Oh, my God. You really have to do that. He's in charge of Warner Archives.
Sure.
He's kind of the guy. Yeah, I know him from those days as well. I never worked for Films Inc. I only worked for UA 16, but we also had the Disney 16mm license as well. They were non-exclusive. I guess they were just with anybody.
Sure.
And so I remember one day, I was so fascinated that I love Disney, and I was just so in love with the Disney films, and I was working with Leonard actually on his second edition of his book, The Disney Films. I worked on that, and I had access to whatever they had in 16, and the local office was in a place called Cranfield, I think it was, or Canfield or Cranfield, New Jersey. It was some place I never heard of, but it was in New Jersey, and I was just fascinated to say, well, gee, there's a big Disney depot in New Jersey, and I was just obsessed with one day wanting to visit it because it was so close and yet so far. And I did. One day I did. I don't know what I was doing or what my excuse was, but I made some excuse to visit the guy that we talked to on the phone regularly and to come out there. And I took the PATH train from Manhattan to New Jersey and then that Dixon bus. And I had to find this address. And the guy was like telling me in advance, you have no reason to come here. There's no reason to come out here, but you know, if you really want to. And I kind of did. I wanted to see the Disney office in New Jersey. And I now understand why he, you know, was shooing me away. It was the oddest experience I've ever seen. It was on a suburban residential street. I mean, I don't know if I took a cab from a bus station or I don't know what. I told the guy the address. We found the place. It was row after row of, you know, single or two-story houses, you know, trees, regular block, you know, it wasn't a business district or anything. And in the middle of a block was I think two-story, may have been only one story, may have only been one now that I think about it. It was like a cinder block building. It was, in my mind, if I lived on that block, it was really an eyesore, you know, because the rest of the street was beautiful houses. And then there was this cinder block office building in the middle of it. And it was totally nondescript. It didn't say Walt Disney in big letters on it. Can you imagine that? But it didn't say anything. And I knocked on the door, and I think it said deliveries in the back. Walked around the back, and it was really just a warehouse where this one guy represented the Disney. Of course, all he did was ship out of this location, and it didn't matter because UPS would come by every day and pick up. And it was really nothing. I mean, maybe they had a few Disney posters on the wall, and they had all the 16mm film. There's Bambi, and there's, you know, the world's greatest athlete, and, you know, there was all that stuff. But it was so odd that, I don't know, I just had to relate that to someone who might understand.
But I understand completely, it was cool.
It was cool as a film buff. It was like, wow. Behind these walls are all these cool Technicolor prints. You know?
Well, the one great thing about working for 16 distributors was that you could bring the prints home.
Yes.
And so every night, I had a 16 projector and a screen at home. Every single night, I'd take something home. And at Films Inc. in Atlanta, I often took things home, but they often didn't have to because we had a terrific screening room and we had a 16 projector with a 6,000 foot reel. So toward the end of the day, I just picked whatever I was going to watch, mounted on a 6,000 foot reel, put it up there, and I wouldn't even have to go change reels or anything.
That's fantastic. Of course, yeah, I had a studio apartment in New York, but I luckily was able to get one when I had already started collecting, and I found this great apartment that had a long throw. It was just a big long apartment. It was one room, but it had a big throw, and that's all I cared about. And I concocted a screen situation. What screen material? Anyway, I made my own little screening room, and I would have my friends over all the time watching. And I had the one advantage, I didn't have the library that you guys had. But we did, ultimately. I mean, ultimately, we had the MGMs later. We got them later in my early on, we had just the Warners and the UA films, and we had all the shorts. And I also had the advantage of being able, we were actually in the headquarters of United Artists, 729 7th Avenue, which I found out later was where Van Buren Animation was done out of.
Wow.
And Fleischer was right across the street at 1600 Broadway. But and United Artists was in that building since 1919 when they were founded. But they, at the time when I was there in the late 70s, early 80s, they had taken over they were the entire building. And but the James Bond movies, Pink Panther movies, whatever was new, and I was able to borrow anything that was, you know, I worked there, I guess, around the time of, New York, New York, or The Black Stallion. I remember these movies being brand new when I borrowed them, you know, and I was able to borrow these movies and bring them home. And that also taught me something that I still tell people today, that it was commonplace for the studios, and I think this goes way, way back to the 30s, that it was commonplace that when they struck prints, release prints, they would also make a 16 neg, and they would strike some 16s for the executives and for people in-house. That was their way of sharing and seeing a movie. So, because that's what they did at UA. They made 16s the minute a movie was finished. They had a 16 that the executives could borrow. Luckily, you know, after a while, us lowly other people who were involved in the 16 millimeter universe were able to borrow them. And that's a lot of collectors, especially with cartoon stuff, are wondering, you know, how there could be 16 millimeter prints of some rare titles. And I just think I just believe it was commonplace to run a 16 neg and print, and maybe multiples of them, at the same time you ran a 35. It just seems that way to me based on my years of collecting experience. And that opens a whole new world, that the fact that a rare film could exist in 16. If you can't find the 35s, the 16 material could be out there.
And it's also the case that for the armed services.
Yes, that's true.
They would run 16 exclusively.
You're
so
right.
They would strike things just
you're
like
right.
That.
Definitely from World War II on, yeah. There was no question that they did that. And they did it with shorts. A lot of the cartoons we have today with the original titles, not the ones that Warner's uses to restore, but collector's prints, for all studios, sometimes the only reason they exist with the original titles is because of those army prints. I've had many, many examples of that. I have friends who pick up army reels, you know, or just they got them from the army, and they're reels of 16. They got multiple things on them, including cartoons, and the cartoons got all the original titles on them. It's fantastic, but it's the joys of collecting.
Absolutely. Do you have a favorite studio, animation studio? I mean, I know that you have Catholic tastes in terms of animation, but
I'm wide open.
Something that you particularly
well, like? I have guilty pleasures, and I have of course superior. I like everything. I mean, I really can't answer. Not your problem. I'm going to try to think about it and answer it. But when people ask you what's your favorite cartoons. I'm sort of glad about the book I worked on called The 50 Greatest Cartoons. That's not my selection. But honestly, boy, oh boy, I'd say 75% of the ones in there are probably my favorite cartoons. I mean, the first Superman cartoon from the Fleischers, cartoons like, I happen to like Book Review is one of my, a lot of the Clampett cartoons are just absolute favorites. The Tex Avery cartoons. I like a lot of the Disney Silly Symphonies, especially the ones that are just eye-poppingly spectacular, like Wink and Blink and a Nod doesn't get enough attention.
That's gorgeous.
I love that film. Yeah, and there's a few of them from that era that are just masterpieces. And I mean, they're apples and oranges in a way. I can't separate them out. It's like the first Superman is so different from a Clampett, but I love them equally.
And
I really do.
There's also that the Disney cartoons are incredibly beautiful. They're beautifully made, but they're almost never funny.
Well, that's true, especially of the 40s
cartoons.
And the thing about the Disney films are when they're good, they're really good. You know, De Fuhrer's Face. And there's a couple of great goofy cartoons that are really funny.
Usually, Clock Cleaners is one of the greats.
Clock Cleaners is in my book. Oh yeah,
great, yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot of when they're good, they're really, really great, and when they're not, they're mediocre. You know, the funny thing I say about I said this for decades now about the Columbia cartoons is that they're either. Because after having watched so many of them, I finally came to a conclusion that they're one or the other. They're either really weird or horrible. There's no any other ground. You know, they're either really weird or horrible. And usually if they're good, they're really weird. Like a Little Match Girl, you know, which is a very sad cartoon. Beautiful cartoon. Really weird, you know. It's on and on. But there's never any middle ground with those. You know, so take my advice if you check out the Columbia Screen Gems cartoons.
Oh, believe me, I've seen them all. Well, we watched a scrappy cartoon of the Sons of the Desert meeting the other night, because it had all these movie star cameos, including Laurel and Hardy, of course. So, not funny and peculiar enough.
Peculiar. That's another way of putting it. But that's the thing about all the studios. All of them have their highs and their lows. There's great ones from all of them, and there's some horrible ones from all of them, including Warner Brothers, you know.
Yeah, the Fleischers had an incredibly rich period,
yes.
Say 1931 to 33. And then some pretty good ones thereafter.
Yeah.
And then the two features, which are terrific.
Right. And Superman.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Love the Superman cartoons. Those are, in terms of sheer physical beauty, that's almost as great as the Fleischers ever got.
Yeah. I'm glad they kind of went out with a bang with that.
But of course, also the Popeye, the two real Popeyes.
I agree with everything you said, and my only asterisk would have been, that I think there's an exception for the Popeyes. I think the Popeyes only begin to get a little sour around 1940, and that's only because I think they're taking all their good people off of the films to work on Gulliver and Mr. Bug. So they kind of sink a bit. And then they kind of once those features are done and now Famous Studios has taken over, to me they kind of go back up a bit. They go back up a notch for a while, and then they sink later. But Popeye's kind of an exception. The character is so strong that it really worked for a long, long time. Some of the things are debatable. I mean, I like a lot of the color classics. There's a couple of duds, but I like most of those. Some of the stuff they did, those things they did at the very end, that are miscellaneous, like Animated Antics, and, I don't know if you know those.
I didn't even know that.
They did a series with, those are the ones that, they're black and white miscellaneous cartoons, of which some of them contained characters from Gulliver's Travels, like, Twinkle Toes the Pigeon and Sneak, Snoop, and Snitch the villains. Believe it or not, you know, they made these. They're horrible, though. The problem is they're not funny. They're just, and they also made this series called Stone Age cartoons. Do you know those? Kind of a precursor to the Flintstones. They unfortunately they're horribly unfunny. They're just horribly. They made a whole series like 1 year of them, maybe 2 years. It's just really awful punny gags, and it's kind of like those late screen songs. Again, I'm way immersed in these.
Oh,
but
yeah.
The late ones, the early ones are great, but the late ones being the mid-30s, where almost all of them are a newsreel, a parody of a newsreel. So they get away with the most least animation they possibly can. And then at one point in the newsreel, they'll suddenly cut to, you know, and now Fred Waring and his orchestra or something like that. And they'll have, and that's the saving grace of the cartoon, you know. And then, you know, then those jazz collectors who cut all those things out, and us cartoon collectors who have these 3 minute long screen songs. But those were the days. But now we've got all these things on video.
Well, sure. It's great. Although, as you said, I would love for somebody to do a deluxe Betty Boop set. The Popeye DVD sets have been very nice.
Yeah.
But I would love, especially during that rich period before the code tamed her. And especially because there's so much great music in there too. Yeah. I mean, gosh.
Yeah. That's probably the biggest crime of the unreleased cartoons from all the studios is the Betty Boops and all the Fleischers are not released. And it's kind of sad. I mean, I have friends over at the UCLA Film Archive where they have a lot of the original negatives and stuff, and they've restored some. And it's up to them, because Paramount isn't saying, we'll give you the money, restore our cartoon library. And they own them today, by the way. They own that library again. You know, people think they don't own them because they sold them away to the UM&M TV Corp. They did. But it came back to them, throughout the years. It came back to them through the fact that NTA acquired them. You probably know all this stuff. NTA acquired them. And NTA,
but our listeners
NTA
don't.
Which became Republic, was then acquired by, I'm forgetting now, the spelling and Blockbuster. And then Viacom purchased that. And so thus that library is back in their hands, and internally they have given those cartoons to Paramount. That they are in charge of them, but they've done a few little restorations here and there, but there's no program to do so.
Well, that's all part and parcel of the whole early 30s Paramount movies in general, features and everything. They're just not available.
Yeah, well,
except for just a rare, you know, the W.C. Fields and the
Marx
Brothers.
Well, the features are more so because, and they're in good hands because those were sold to Universal.
Yeah.
And the good news is Universal has most of the materials and looks to me, based on what I know, they have a little bit of a restoration program. They have been making the classics available. If you go to Cinecon or we see some early, we see all those oddball musicals with Shemp, you know, from the 40s that nobody's running anywhere.
No.
And they're not on DVD, but they're restoring them and they look great.
Well, that's why I always say if you live in this area and you don't go to Cinecon, you're a sap.
Oh, you're with me, man.
You're a sap.
You are.
That's where the weird, rare stuff is shown that you're not going to see anywhere else.
I know people are spoiled by TCM. We would have loved TCM back in our day, but it's not the only thing. In fact, the good thing about Cinecon is that's where the stuff that way before it may end up on TCM, but it's at Cinecon first. Sometimes it's only there.
TCM is a treasure. Believe me, treasure.
Yeah,
but They do tend to go for the
classics.
The classics.
I mean, am I the only person? I've never heard anybody say this. I haven't checked the chat boards, and I don't check and read all that stuff. But does anybody else feel like me that you can write off the month of February? That's their 31 days of Oscars. Hey, look, nothing wrong with all the movies running that month. But
I
like getting that booklet every month, and I like seeing Jungle Jim on Saturday morning, and I like going through the whole thing picture by picture and finding that gem. They're only running at 3 a.m, you know, that 59-minute gem that they never ran before. I mean, that's what I want. They seem to have occasionally a day, once or twice a month, maybe if we're lucky, where they seem to just run nothing but B movies.
Yeah,
I love that. It's unannounced and they don't bring any spotlight on it, but they do it, you know.
Do you remember the first year of TNT?
Yes, that's when it was good.
That was
TCM before TCM.
TCM with commercials.
Right.
But nevertheless, they were showing stuff that,
well,
you know, the CBAT.
Well, no. The reason is because it was totally reliant on the library, which was the MGMUA library at that time, which was, you know, the all those old Warner Brothers films, and I think they had the MGM films as well, and at that point that's all they had, so they ran everything. They're really still that way today. They still have that library and they will run any nook and cranny that's in there. You know, I'm always asking about certain oddball films, and friends of mine will say, oh, they ran that 3 months ago. They did? I missed it. Oh, damn. But at least they ran it, and I know they'll...
Yeah.
And A, I know a friend who probably taped it, and B, I know they'll run it again. You know, I remember a couple of months ago, I was dying to show somebody Gabriel Over the White House, which is a great film, which I hadn't seen in years, and I knew that TCM was running it, but I was, like, ignoring it. And then they just ran it. I missed it, and I just got into a conversation about it with somebody. Said, oh, my God, I have to tape it. And I waited, and they finally just ran it about 2 weeks ago. So
it's a good movie.
Yes.
Talk about a weird movie. That's a great weird one. Actually, doing all this TCM talk is a great segue, isn't it, to a very special night coming up.
Here's the trick. I had the wonderful... wonderful opportunity to not only suggest some programming to TCM, which was a dream come true right there, but then they asked me to come on and be with Robert, as they said. And I never expected that to happen. I feel like going all the way back with you because I know you can edit this and whether you do or not. But what happened is I'm friends with George Feltenstein from a million years ago. I worked for UA16. I know that library like the back of my hand. And I've been involved with Warner Home Video and, you know, all along. But I never knew anybody at TCM. And of course I love TCM, but I never knew anybody there and I never really had any reason to really contact them anyway. But I had started building up some thoughts, of some ideas. I had been doing screenings in LA, which I do at the Cine Family, and at LACMA, the museum. And I've also done screenings at the Academy and the Egyptian and many other places. And I come up with these ideas for programs, And it just occurred to me some of these ideas would really be great on TCM, like pre-code cartoons or film noir cartoons.
Sure.
So I started making a list, which I of these things I had been doing, and some other ideas. And then 6 months ago, a year ago, I think it was a year ago now, TCM with their sub license with Sony to put out some of the Columbia films, as they're also putting out Universal films under the TCM archive label on video. But they had a sub license with Sony, and on their own, I had nothing to do with it. I didn't contact them. They realized they had some cartoons there, but what they didn't have was Mr. Magoo, because Sony had already sub-licensed those to Shout Factory, who hasn't put them out yet, but they are. And so, to their credit, TCM said, "Well, we'll take the other stuff." The other stuff being the other UPA cartoons. Now, of course, we know that Sony has all those other Scrappies and Crazy Cats and Fox and Crow cartoons and Color Rhapsodies. But so they put out the this Jolly Frolics collection, and luckily for me, they asked Leonard Maltin to do an introduction for it and to do some commentary. And Leonard, in turn, came to me and asked me to get involved. And both I did helped him with some audio commentary, but also provided some material for the booklet. I actually pointed them towards my good friend Adam Abraham, who wrote a great book on UPA that came out last year. And they actually asked me if I would write something for the booklet, and I said, you know what? This guy just did a book on it. And this, you know, so I'm not hogging anything. Hire him and get him to do it. He just spent years researching UPA. Nobody could be better than him. So I pointed him, and they got him to do the booklet. And so I was involved a little with that DVD. And so I put that on my list. Like, why isn't TCM running some of these cartoons that they have the rights to? You know, so that was on my list. And I had this list going, and it was by my bed. And I kept thinking, okay, one day I'm going to call up George Feltenstein and say, who's your contact at TCM? Because I know you know the people there. Just give me a name, I'll call them, and maybe I can make an appointment, like a business meeting, and just pitch them some of these things that they should do. And I think that's a fantasy that all people who watch TCM probably have, right? It's not about money, it's not about anything. It's just like, I'd love it if you would do this, you know? Wouldn't it be cool if you did that, you know? So I had that wish list, I had that fantasy, but one day out of the blue, a guy calls me up. I remember it was like in the morning, because it's, you know, it's 9 o'clock here, it's like, it was really early in the morning. I think it might have been 8 or something. And I guess it was somebody calling from Atlanta. You know, they didn't know what time it was here. But I got up, and they had some questions about some silent cartoons that they had acquired. And they wanted to ask me some questions about that. And I told them, they told me what they were talking about. I don't even know if they acquired them yet, but they were talking about possibly getting them. I said, well, that sounds like really good stuff, and I would definitely acquire that. And, you know, that sounds like fantastic. I said, by the way, who am I speaking to? And he told me his name, and he said, well, what do you do there? Well, I program them now. You program? Would you mind if I just mentioned a few things? I love the channel, and I you know, can I just tell you a few things that I'd love to, you know, see myself that are all, I thought them all out. They were all things they could do. Because even when I said film noir cartoons or pre-codes, I knew already what they had the rights to.
Sure.
So everything, it was not like you had to go out and acquire. It was like, you know, you actually could do this, you know. So I read this laundry list of stuff. I mean, and I was on the phone for at least an hour with this guy, maybe longer. In fact, I realized at some point 45 minutes into it, oh my God, he's really listening to me, because we're on a long time and he's listening to me. And he's writing, he's taking notes. I mean, maybe he's going to do this. And it was a great phone call. It was definitely over an hour. And I hung up, and I felt refreshed. And I said, I don't know, I felt like I heard, maybe they'll do it. And then a month later, he called me back and said, look, I'm working on some of these, blah, blah, blah. And he had some questions, and, oh yeah, oh, you know, you can get, oh, if you can't get that one, try blah, blah, blah. And I would give him some other things and whatever. And this went on for a couple of months, like once a month I would hear from him. And things, changes had to be made. The whole thing about pre-code and all that was tabled, you know, for now. But what other things came up, we had found out that Paramount had recently restored from the original negatives, Mr. Bug and Gulliver. And so he went after that. And he got them. Asterix. I'll get back to that asterix in a minute. And then on and on. And finally, at one point, he said, okay, we're going to do this. Again, this is all months in advance, you know, because we're going to do it. We're going to air this. We're going to have a whole block of rare animation. We're going to do it in October. And this was like in April or something this year. And he was like, you know, would you come on with Robert to help introduce? I go, okay. And so, you know, I anything to help make it happen. So, anyway, that was a whole wonderful experience. I won't go into all of that right now, but we did that. And it was taped way in advance.
Where did you do it? New York or Atlanta?
Atlanta and the TBS headquarters down there.
I'd been told that Osborne was doing his stuff in New York now.
But, I didn't know that. Yeah. I don't know. Maybe now.
It may be wrong.
But back in May or June when we taped it. I can't remember now. I think it was late May or late June. That we taped it, and it was in Atlanta, and he was in great shape. He really was. Great guy, had a great experience. I can't say anything bad about the experience. The experience in everybody, fantastic. And, except for one thing, I was incredibly nervous. So if you're listening to this in advance, I don't know how I come off, but I know that I was, I love TCM so much. I told this to them right there on this. I said, I love this channel so much. This is the Film Buff badge of honor to be here. You know, you know, keep doing what you're doing. Keep on doing what you're doing, as Wheeler and Woolsey might say. And I was really tongue-tied. And I was also what you see on camera is what you get because, although it's edited, because I say it's edited because we taped about 6 minutes at each for each block. We did 9 segments. And each one was, as far as I know, edited to 3 minutes, unless I'm wrong. I mean, I haven't seen them all myself, but I saw one of the segments, and it was edited to 3 minutes. And so I know there's edits. And also, I had all kinds of wonderful anecdotes that I had filled my head with in advance, kind of like boning up for one of the presidential debates. I totally filled my head with all sorts of things to say about Gulliver and Mr. Bug and all this. And then I get on, there was no pre-interview. So I got on the set and Robert starts asking me questions about, tell us about the Fleischer Studios and things like that. And I'm like, oh, and my mind was thinking, I want to tell you that Popeye was supposed to be in Gulliver and I want to tell you these other things that would be really cool to the audience. It's the kind of thing you might say. But you're asking me about the Fleischer. Okay, so I had to do a quick in my brain adjustment to talking about. I mean, almost everything he asked me was like I didn't know where. You know, I wasn't expecting that question, so I don't know how it comes off. I did not see it, so I'm looking forward to seeing it with everybody else. Also, to get back to the asterisk, and I think whether no one told me not to talk about this, but I'm gonna talk about this now, which is that I have no idea 1 week before it airs what versions of Mr. Bug and Gulliver they're going to be airing, although I'm crossing my fingers that they have the original titles and are really good prints, and maybe they're even the Paramount restorations. I don't know. What I do know is that one point along the way after I taped the intros, Paramount, who they licensed this from and agreed to give them their restorations, called them back and said, oh, we did license to you, but we realize now that we did restore we made a restoration neg. I don't know what that's called, but we made a new neg to make prints off of. Oh, and maybe they even made a print. Oh, I think they even made an answer print. Of course, they probably had to. But they didn't transfer it to video. To any digital or anything. So there was another tens of thousands cost per film that they wanted in order to get it to video. I'm like, and of course the guy was calling me saying, we can't afford it. We'd love to, but we can't. We don't have that money. It was a lot of money. A lot. I mean, I'm not going to say, but it's just imagine a very high figure, not $10,000, a lot more per. So the hunt was on for the best possible prints, and I do know that we tried many, 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 many leads, including Europe. And I have to tell you, I know for a fact that some of those leads did turn up things late, late, late in the game. But I don't know what's going to be on the air. So I'm hoping for the best. I'm crossing my fingers. But here's the thing. What's more important, this is the most important thing. To go back to the beginning of this whole adventure with TCM, I want to see classic animation. I want to see an outlet for classic animation somewhere. TCM is the best place for such an outlet. It's what I said to you early on in this conversation, that animation is sort of the stepchild to film history. Well, even at TCM, it didn't really occur to me until recently, that even at TCM, animation is sort of down there. And like they show silent movies on Sunday night, and foreign films, and eclectic weird stuff on Friday, and Jungle Gym on Saturday morning, I'd love there to be an hour, two, three on maybe Sunday night before the silence or something like that. I'd love there to be a regular block of classic animation of some sort, curated the right way. And I'm, again, raising my hand to volunteer this. I've given them some stuff already. Some ammunition.
I second that nomination.
I've already given them some. I mean, the list of stuff I've given them already that was supposed to be for this show, they have plenty for another block. But I'd like to see that happen. I don't care if I'm on it or not. Get John Canemaker. There's many other wonderful historians as well. I just want to see it happen. We need it. The film community needs it. The animation community needs it. I'm a teacher of animation history now. I teach at Woodbury University in Burbank. And there are one thing I've learned in the last few years is there are animation courses at every school now. They're never – when I was – young. I come from New York. We had the School of Visual Arts, and maybe NYU had a film course. Of course, they did. Out in LA, there was UCLA and USC, of course, and Cal Arts. But quite frankly, I don't think any other schools back in the day had big film courses, and God forbid, an animation course, and beyond that, an animation history class. I now am under the impression that all these, not only the ones we just mentioned, have this, but it seems to me every school in the country does. And I say this from the point of view of my blog. Oh, got to get a plug in for that. Cartoon Brew. We do a student festival every year on our blog, and we all year long, 365 days a year, we get students from around the world and America, of course, sending in their films. So, and I can't believe where these films are coming from. They're coming from every college in the country. And as a new teacher of animation history, because good news, boys and girls, you can grow up and be like me. I didn't know you could be like me when I was young, but you could. There is actually a profession now of being an animation history teacher. And the young kids today, the 20-year-olds, the 18-year-olds that are in college, did not grow up with Tex Avery, did not grow up, maybe they saw some Looney Tunes, and of course they probably saw Tom and Jerry, but they didn't see Woody Woodpecker, Mighty Mouse, and a million other things, not to mention European and all that other stuff that I personally grew up with. I grew up in New York, and I would go to the Museum of Modern Art a lot, and they would run a lot of, stuff from around the world, so I got a real good broad education on that. But there's really no place to see any of that stuff anymore.
We have an entire generation who's never even seen Deputy Dog.
You got it. Right, that alone. So I think that I love the first selection of stuff that we're doing. We are showing, of course, UPAs. We're showing a wonderful collection from the collection of collector Tom Stathis in New York, who is the main, I want to say preeminent authority, but he's the biggest collector of silent animation. He's in his 20s, but he is dedicated. He's like us when we were in our 20s, dedicated to silent animation and its preservation. And he's where they got the silent cartoons from. And he's really bent over backwards to not only he had these films when he was talking to them about offering them up, but then once he sold them, he went out of his way to get better copies, going to archives and doing all kinds of upgrades and things he didn't have to do. To make this the best possible presentation. And we're showing an hour of those, which will include one sound a Van Buren cartoon, by the way, just as a preface. I haven't mentioned that many other places. We also show The Adventures of Prince Ahmed, which is the pre-Walt Disney first animated feature. Although every time I say that, someone says, it isn't the first animated feature. Well, it's the earliest animated feature that exists. There's apparently one or two animated features that were made, like one of which was made in Argentina and things like that, but they don't exist. Nobody has copies, and we'd love to see it. But we have some evidence of that. But Prince Ahmed is an actual great film. It's silhouette animation, cutout animation, and it's abstract, and it's wonderful.
It's hard to get people enthusiastic about it by telling them that it's a silhouette film.
I know.
But it's really wonderful.
It is, and not only that, I hate to even use the word abstract because it's a narrative film. It has a great story, but it also has some great abstract animation. It's kind of like an animated Metropolis, because it has abstract images in it, and yet it tells a great story. In fact, it's what's interesting about it is, not only was it done by one woman, right there, a woman, one person,
one.
A woman, in France and Germany, but what's funny, what's interesting in it is that there's actually nude scenes. There's actually a scene with where the prince comes across some sea nymphs, and they're naked. But the thing is, it's silhouette, so you don't really see anything, but it's more than implied they're naked. So check that out, folks. We're also, of course, showing the two great Fleischer animated features. And, I'm just excited that these are on the same stage as the stage being TCM as the other great films. It's funny because when I started talking about Gulliver and Mr. Bug to the TCM programmer, I had to do the real sales pitch. I mean, I was doing it anyway, but these are Paramount Pictures. Gulliver was a big hit. Great songs that are still known today came out of them. There was a lot to say about these two movies, but the fact that they're part of classic Hollywood, one of my favorite things to mention, I don't remember if I said this with Robert, and I don't know if it'll get cut out or not, but all the studios in Hollywood were affected by Snow White. Snow White was such a gigantic hit that every studio had to have a Snow White. Only Paramount went to their animation studio and said, make us an animated feature. MGM made The Wizard of Oz. Fox made The Bluebird. These were their responses to the phenomenal success of a fairy tale movie. And so, but I mentioned that as well. It's part of where Gulliver comes from, is that it's just part of that, what was going on at that time.
What I've always found interesting about the whole Gulliver experience was that they actually moved to Florida.
Oh, yeah.
And created basically a college to train people how to work on Gulliver.
Not
just a general animation college, but they were training people
to
work on that film.
Yeah.
How long did production go on for that?
It wasn't that long. It was probably 2 years or less. It was very short because they wanted to write. It came out in 1939. I mean, and Sleeping Beauty, I think, came out at the end of 1937. I'm sorry, Snow White. What did I say?
Sleeping Beauty.
I'm sorry. Oh, gosh. I'm so sorry. I'm tired. I said Sleeping Beauty. I meant Snow White. Snow White came. Thank you.
Hey, we all got it.
Thank God I have a film buff. if you weren't you, the person wouldn't have corrected me. That pretty much tells the tale right there. I mean, pretty much they spent 1938 and some of 1939 making the movie.
Yeah.
It's
a terrific film. I introduced it at the Monterey Film Festival a couple of years ago. Had a beautiful IB-35 print from a friend of mine, but pretty splicey. But it was beautiful where it was good. And I love the movie pretty much in its entirety, but they never did get the hang of the humans particularly. They all, the rotoscope looks a little two-dimensional or something.
Well, I'll tell you, I've come to love, I think I never not liked it, but I've really come to love the Gulliver rotoscoping, and I actually think it really works. It really was a great way to kind of get you into it, especially normal audiences, not just animation people. It gave you something, it made it a little more relatable, believe it or not.
Gulliver, I was talking about the Prince and the Princess.
The Prince and the Princess, yeah. Well, they had a long way to go, and doing that. I mean, they had a lot to catch up on, trying to catch up to Disney right away.
But you could also say the same thing about Disney. The Prince in Snow White is no great shakes.
It isn't, but
he's getting there, but he's not.
Yeah, but they were still leaps and bounds over everybody else. I mean, they were, you know, they were on a real roll with what they were doing. And
they were not rotoscoping. And we probably should talk a little bit about rotoscoping because I don't know how many people know what that is. But Disney was doing reference footage and their animators were animating to it.
Yeah.
But the Fleischers took it to another level, which was rotoscoping.
Well, they took it to another level, but we must remember that the Fleischers invented the rotoscope in the teens, and it was the invention to trace live action, photograph. It was just an invention. It was a light stand that would they could project film up to the glass. Tablet at the top, and then the animator could put a piece of paper over that and trace. And it was literally a physical invention.
Yeah.
But it's still in use, believe it or not, even in these days of mocap, and they still use that when necessary. It's very rare these days, but it was of course used later, for those Ralph Bakshi movies. And it's used a lot in science fiction films and special effects, and, I know that Star Wars, and, you know, whenever they needed to do certain special effects, they would have to use that unit or a modified version of the same invention. So
were the Fleischers able to keep hold of the copyright and everything of that? I'd like to think.
Well, no, I think it was a patent, and I have a feeling that it ran out at one point. I don't think they were reaping rewards for the rest of their lives on that. I mean, poor Max Fleischer, you know, was trying to regain his footing ever since he was ousted from the studio, and you know, and since then he had multiple lawsuits with Paramount throughout the years, and it's kind of weird. It was kind of a bittersweet thing because it was kind of a soft takeover because, first of all, you know, if you don't know anything about it, and the way we were back in the 70s when nobody knew anything, it was like the Fleischers had their studio and then Paramount just took it over. Well, it wasn't that simple. You know, Paramount was loaning them and paying them money and forwarding them future money to keep their studio going. And as they did, they kept getting shares of their studio. And then when they built them this giant plant in Florida, the building of which still exists, the Fleischers were heavily in debt to Paramount. And so it was basically a matter of Paramount at some point just saying, we're going to replace you, and that's that. And then, since you're not there anymore, we're going to, you know, not call it Fleischer Studios anymore, you know. That's why the films really don't change that much in that year when it goes from Fleischer to Famous. They're really not that dissimilar, you know.
Didn't you say you went down to Florida? You saw the studio?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I one of my pilgrimages. I have family in Florida, and 1 year now it's a long time ago, about 20 years ago. I went and I had to find that location. Luckily, in Leslie Cabarga's book, the Fleischer Story, he prints a map. It's actually a blueprint of the entire studio, like what was in each part of the building. But it also contains the street corners on it. So I just went to that street corner and found the building, and there it is. And it looks like it does in the book, except obviously it's decades later, and they took the words Fleischer Studios off it and things like that. And I went in, and it was at the time of some kind of a Planned Parenthood thing. It was a government-owned family planning facility. And I went in, and I just explained, and I had the map with me. I said, hi, do you guys know that, you know, I'm not here for what you're servicing. I would like to look at the building. I'm a film buff. This was built as an animation. And they were like, oh, really? You know, and they let me look around, which was really cool. And what was the scoring stage is now a gymnasium. And, but it's the same building. And right there above the basketball hoops were the windows for the projection booth. And there was a little door, and I asked they had somebody come with me. I said, can I go up there? He goes, well, we don't know what, that's just a closet. It's a stairway to a closet. I'm like, really? Can I? And so I went in there, and there was no electricity, and it was pitch black. And I kept thinking, I'm going to put my hands on the floor. Maybe there's a drawing from a Superman cartoon laying around, you know. And there was nothing. It was just an empty. I could tell just without even seeing anything. It was pitch black that it was just an empty room up there. But I did look out the window, you know. There was barely any light in there. But the only other thing that was of interest, I mean, there was nothing other than to be there physically and look around at it. But I remember needing to go to the bathroom, and I'm glad I did, because the bathroom was, you can tell, at least 20 years ago, the fixtures were all of the era. I mean, they didn't change a thing. I mean, you know, Dave Fleischer pissed here, you know, no question about it, you know.
Wow.
But it was very cool. It was very, you felt the spirit. Hey, they were there. This was it. I looked all around. It was so cool.
Oh, that's the sort of thing I would do. I go to places like that and try to conjure what ghosts I can from.
Yeah, we still have in LA. We still have some great, you know, ghost buildings.
We sure do. Yeah.
Yeah.
My low battery thing, but it's probably not a bad time to wrap it up.
See, too bad.
It's been 1 hour 9 minutes. So.
Well, we could obviously do lots more once you get new batteries.
Well, if you want to keep going, I can change my batteries, but we can. I can give you an easy out now.
I'll take that out. No.
What I think we should do is have another podcast appearance by you.
Oh, okay.
In the not too distant future. And
I would do that. Yes. So, let's do that. I'm sure there's more we can really get into the nitty gritty of talking about cartoons.
Boy,
you know,
I could talk cartoons all day long, as I'm sure you know. So, But thank you very much, Jerry Beck. This has been great, and I've been hoping to have you on since before there even was a podcast. So,
thank you.
This has been terrific, and everybody should watch the TCM, and I'll post all the information on the site and. We'll have all the links and everything into Cartoon Brew and all that.
Okay. Thank you.
Everything that is Jerry Beck will be on the Commentary Track website. Thanks a lot, Jerry.
Thank you.
I sure had a great time talking cartoons with Jerry Beck, and I hope you enjoyed listening. As we talked about at some length, the TCM Animation Night is coming up on Sunday, October 21st. Check your local listings. But don't you worry, because on the Commentary Track website, which is called thecommentarytrack.com, we'll have the schedule, we'll have links to the page, we'll have links to Jerry's blog, and we'll have everything you need to know about Jerry Beck will be on the thecommentarytrack.com page. Even Amazon links to his books and to DVDs for which he's provided commentary. And if you want to own those things, and I highly suggest that you do want to own them all, if you'll click on the Amazon links on my site, then I'll get a little bit of love back from Amazon, and that will be very cool for me, because mighty oaks from tiny acorns grow, and the tiny few cents I get for everything that's ordered on Amazon through my site will finally grow into a mighty empire in which I will reign over all. And I think that'll be fun. It'll be a lot of fun for me anyway. So I hope that you will join me again next week. And I'm going to have a little bonus commentary track coming up later on in the week because I want to address the passing of a good friend of mine and somebody who's been very important in my life for the last couple of years. And I think he deserves his own commentary track. Is Bob Wade. Bob was the co-writer, co-director, co-editor, co-star, co-creator with his partner H. Billy Miller of the Bogeste parody in 1939, and that's what my documentary, The Lost Remake of Bogeste, is all about. And so his passing has been incredibly sad for me because he and I have been on this journey that's been exhilarating for me and just, I think, kind of weird for him. But I think he enjoyed it too. And so I want to spend some time talking about him and about the adventures that we had together. So that'll be coming up a little bit later in the week. It'll be a bonus episode. It won't be a real commentary track. It'll be shorter than the rest. In the meantime, I want to thank my beautiful wife, Claire McCullough, for being my announcer. I want to thank James Hutchins for designing not only my commentary track website, thecommentarytrack.com, but also my personal website, which is now up and running and is just cute as a bug. It's called www.frankthompson.tv, and I hope that you will go there. It's just a little bit more personal, but I'm going to be posting some interviews that I've done with people over the years, like Robert Wise and other notables, and a lot of stuff from the archives I'm going to be putting up there. But I also, people have started contacting me about my annual holiday letter, and so the new one of those is going to be coming up in just another month plus. And if you really want a trip into the bazaar, I hope that you'll read that. So anyway, That's another episode of the Commentary Track, Lost to History. And I hope you'll be back next week. And in the meantime, don't you worry. We're going to fix it in post.